Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning and Music at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and Theologian in Residence of Canvas Community in Little Rock, Arkansas. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
Today we read Acts chapter 18, verses 1 through 4, and 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 10 through 18. Our introduction to the city of Corinth, a busy port city with all kinds of diversity and disparity, almost like an ancient Las Vegas. And here in this city, Paul tasks the budding church with finding a way to profound unity. Speaking to a people that seem prone to latch onto the messenger instead of the message, as we humans like to do, Paul does whatever he can to sever that connection, even when it's painful, in order to insist that his listeners find a common anchor point in something much bigger, something that unites them all, the cross itself and only that. Is it possible for us humans to connect to something that big without holding onto the medium that gets us there? And how do we not lose the forest for the trees? Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Bobby. How you doing?
Hey, Amy. I am pretty good. I have a little bit of an allergies thing going on, maybe.
Yeah.
So it is possible that I'm going to sound a little like... Yes. Right now, yes. I'm doing okay. I've got the Robitussin going on. Doing all right. But I might be a little, you know, nasal. Yeah. More nasal than usual.
It is the season in Atlanta that I'm sure you remember. I don't know if this happens in Little Rock, too, but where, like, the puddles actually turn a sort of neon green around the edges. Enough that... I saw it for the first time when I was running before dawn. Like, it wasn't light outside, but I could see the green around the edges.
Oh, that's amazing. Like, yeah. The little pollen halos. Time. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's so much pollen in the world as plants are being fruitful and multiplying.
They are really very fruitful. Yes, indeed. Well, I hope it won't distress you too much. That's a crummy feeling. I'm sorry you have it.
Well, it is okay. It is okay.
It's going to be okay. Bobby, like last time, the narrative lectionary this week has given us a combination of a little bit of Acts.
Yep.
And then a little bit of one of Paul's letters that is related to the little bit that we have read in Acts. So that today is Acts chapter 18, verses 1 through 4. And then 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 10 through 18.
Yes.
So I'm going to guess that we're in Corinth.
That is true. We are.
Yay! Yeah.
Such a good guess.
Oh, I know.
No, I like the way the narrative lectionary does this. And so this week it'll give us the story of Corinth and then the letter. And then for the next 2 weeks, we're just going to be in 1 Corinthians.
Yeah.
So it's like easing us in. It's like we're sticking our toe in the water.
It is very helpful to me to get a little bit of the, you know, orienting story of the foundation of this place, of this community, and then get into the letters afterwards.
Yeah. Because, I mean, these letters really are, like, they're letters written by Paul to people about things. But when we just read them, there's an old article called Reading Other People's Mail talking about these letters. Mm-hmm. And it's just like you pick up some correspondence from people that you don't know anything about, and you're trying to make sense of it. And so having some historical background so you know a little bit the story so that you can make sense of what's going on in this community is quite helpful.
That's actually really fascinating to think about it as reading other people's letters. Like, these are, while there may be things in the letters that are generally applicable to the church community broadly writ, they're specific.
They are. And that's one of the challenges of thinking about Paul in terms of theology is, what was Paul trying to claim as a, like, Christian principle? And surely he was. And then what are the, like, little individual issues that are going on in these communities that Paul would be horrified if he knew that we had turned it into some sort of universal principle of Christianity.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a delicate matter sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's always the question, how much of this should be generalized and how much was really meant for a particular situation. Bobby, we only have 4 verses to read from the book of Acts, and we have been in the book of Acts.
Yeah.
So is there anything else you'd want to say to us here? I mean, we were just in chapter 17. Should I just go ahead and read us the couple verses in 18?
Yeah, I don't think there's really anything. You know, reading through Acts is really interesting. Paul just goes places and he has really interesting interactions, but I don't think there's anything in between there that we need to know in order to get us ready to read this.
Okay. Then I'm going to go ahead and pick up in chapter 18, verse 1, and I am reading from the NRSV. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. Paul went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they worked together. By trade, they were tent makers. Every Sabbath, he would argue in the synagogue and would try to convince Jews and Greeks. There's your introduction to Corinth.
There you go. Yeah.
Bobby, I am feeling so struck by the fact that this couple that he's staying with is there because all the Jews had been ordered to leave Rome.
Yeah.
It feels almost easy to skip over because, I mean, maybe it goes on to talk more about that later, but it just sort of moves on. It's like they moved here because, you know, they went to graduate school and that's what, you know, it's just presented as part of the story. But do you know anything about the historical context of the expulsion? Do we know anything about that?
Well, we're not entirely clear exactly what Paul is talking about, but there was an expulsion from the city of Rome during the reign of the Emperor Claudius that we know about from Roman historical sources. Mm. If that's what we're talking about, what we know is that the Christians were expelled from Rome, or Jews were expelled from Rome for worshiping one whose name was Christus, which people interpret as being about Jewish worshipers of Jesus. And so there was an expulsion, and I think it was trying to target Christians, but of course it's not always easy to separate Christians and Jews in this early period.
Right.
So what I imagine is happening, although it's not 100% clear, is that Aquila, I say Aquila because, I don't know, Q and U make a qua.
Yeah, I gotcha.
But
that's cool.
In Greek, it's actually Akoulas, and so we could say Akoula. That would be good. Let's not do that. Anywho, it's not entirely clear whether these are Jewish Christians, Jews who are worshiping Jesus as the Messiah already in Rome, or whether these are Jewish Jews who come to Corinth and then discover the gospel. It's not entirely clear. And there are scholars who will argue both sides of that. To me, what's really interesting, though, as you're pointing out, is that this all started because of persecution. And so the whole reason they're there is because the place where they were had become unsafe for them.
It's just such a, I mean, it's such an easy thing to skim over in the text, but also such a foreign thing from my own experience in the world, thank God. And I hope for most of our listeners, too, being expelled from the city or country where they had left. But I love the other thing you were mentioning, too, that we don't know whether this couple was actually followers of Jesus at that time, Jewish followers of Jesus, or whether they were Jews who got caught up in this whole thing and the Empire of Rome didn't distinguish you're this kind of Jew and you're that kind of Jew. They just said, like, out with the whole lot of you.
Right.
And then that also sort of opens up the question of the likely, maybe I shouldn't say the likely relationship between Paul and this couple, but one possible relationship. You know, we don't know. We don't know if they were aligned on the Jesus issue from the beginning.
That's right. That's exactly right. So Priscilla and Aquila become really important sort of co-missionaries with Paul from this point forward. They move on to Ephesus and they found a church in Ephesus. They become really important Christian missionaries, which, by the way, is important not only in itself, but also because Priscilla, the wife of Aquila, is one of the earliest church founders. Obviously, she's a woman. And so this whole idea that women should not be in leadership roles in the church, which has taken on a life of its own, I mean, beginning in like the second century, really in Paul's own ministry seems not to have been the case. But that's a point for another day.
Mm-hmm. But an important one.
Yeah.
An important point for another day.
But whether they themselves were converts of Paul or whether they had become Christian and then met up with Paul in Corinth is not entirely clear. Later on in 1 Corinthians, Paul is going to talk about the people that he baptized in Corinth. Mm-hmm. And Aquila and Priscilla are not among them, which makes some people think that they must have already been Christian, or surely Paul would have baptized them. But he doesn't say that he did. But that's like not solid, you know?
Right.
Can you talk, like, what difference does it make to you if you think about it as they were already Christian when they met Paul, or they were Jews who had to flee from Rome and then met Paul and became Christian?
I mean, it's difficult to try to put myself in their position, but I could imagine a scenario in which if I had been expelled from living in a community because there were certain folks among my people who were creating disruption and the empire didn't like it. And I was basically penalized for things that I wasn't doing and wasn't bought into, I might default toward a state of resentment.
Right.
You know, it might be sort of one more hurdle to overcome.
Sure.
So I wonder about that. It seems different to me to imagine that they were already followers of Jesus. And so if indeed the Jews were expelled because of some relationship to Jesus, then at least they were expelled because of their own beliefs instead of being expelled because they were lumped in with a group of people whose beliefs they did not share.
Yeah.
At that time.
No, that's really helpful. I mean, it's easy to forget how early we are in the Christian story, but we're really early in the Christian story. We're somewhere around maybe the year 50. So 20 years or so after the death and resurrection of Jesus. And so there are Christians. I mean, the gospel spreads quickly. Like, there were a few Christians in a lot of places. There weren't a lot of Christians anywhere, but there were Christians in Rome before Paul gets there. We know that because when he writes the letter to Rome, he's writing to a Christian community that he's never been to. So maybe Priscilla and Aquila are part of that. But it is, I think, entirely plausible to think that they were not. I think I'm leaning toward they were already Christians in Rome. That's where I'm leaning. Mm-hmm. But I like toying with the other possibility.
Yes. The way you just framed it for me, I was like, oh yeah, that does make a lot of sense, and that's who Paul would stay with. But I guess I just like the possibility. I like the fact that is not clear from the text.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it says that he lived with them because they worked in the same trade.
Yeah.
Not he lived with them because they were co-leaders in this budding movement who were already sort of, you know, in this shared vision together. It just feels much more sort of, I don't know, like everyday life. Yeah. We work at the same place, so we might as well carpool kind of.
Yeah.
You know, like that kind of hospitality. So, yeah, I think it's interesting to hold the possibility of that, even if it seems likely that they were Christian.
And we saw that same sort of idea last week in talking about Thessaloniki and Jason, who welcomed in Paul.
Yes.
And he didn't seem to have any prior connection to them as well.
Yes.
And so there does seem to be this sort of this people who welcome, people who get connected in these non-official ways seem to be the way that Paul is operating. People who give him a place to stay, people who have a similar trade to him so they can work together. These are the kinds of connections that he's making.
Yeah.
The fact that one way or the other, they are political refugees also seems really important, that, you know, there are lots of forced migrants today, people displaced from their homes. And so I don't know that that makes that much difference in this story, but just thinking about who they are and that they continue, they're from Turkey. They've been in Rome. Now they're in Corinth. They're going to move to Ephesus at the end of this chapter. Like, they are people who keep moving on behalf of the good news that they have to share. And their sort of refugee status has become, I don't know, it's become part of their ministry almost. It reminds me a little bit of a text that we didn't read, but, you know, we talked a couple weeks ago about the Christian movement is originally just in Jerusalem, and then it expands to Judea and Samaria. The reason it expanded was because Christians started being persecuted in Jerusalem, and so they moved to other places and started evangelizing there. And so this becomes like a similar move. Like, they tried to shut it down in Rome, and then you get Priscilla and Aquila, who then like spread it all like in a whole bunch of different places. And so there is something in this text, at least sort of casually there, about the more you try to suppress the gospel, the more you end up spreading it around the world.
Bobby, this might be a strange question. Do you make anything in particular of the fact that it mentions that they were tent makers? It just seems like such a particular detail.
You can translate the Greek as tent makers, which is how it is often translated. Some people will translate it as leather workers. So maybe they're making other kinds of leather products. I kind of like tent makers. I don't really quite know why. There's this sort of informal way of talking about bivocational pastors in the modern world, like tent makers. Like, I guess I'm technically a tent maker, although my tent making is teaching the Bible at a college.
Proverbial tent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People who like spreading the gospel or whatever, that pastoring a church is what they do kind of and there's free time.
Yeah.
The tent making, I like that, you know, it depends on what you think of tents being about, but if you think of it as like a place that shelters people, and especially places that shelter people who are traveling or in between places or wandering, like, there's a real, I like the metaphor there of making spaces for people who are between spaces or something like that.
Yeah.
What do you do with tent makers?
Oh, I like that a lot. I wasn't thinking as metaphorically, but I like that, especially with the connection that you raised up before, that they really are essentially refugees over and over again. Like, they are constantly moving as the places where they're staying become unsafe for them. I think I was thinking more in the direction of sort of the bivocational pastor, or, you know, the rabbinic tradition. And still today, many people are rabbis who, like, they have a day job. They just also are very learned Jews who do what they need to do to sort of have that status, you know, that title, that it doesn't have to be, that it's woven into everyday life. It's not like a separate class of people or, you know, that it's, these are, they're just, they're folks.
Yeah.
And they're, and the connection that is pulled out here between these individuals is that in this moment is not, I don't know. It feels very sort of kind of simple and grounded to me in a way that I find appealing.
I really like that. They're just folks who are out with the people and doing their thing in an everyday life.
Yeah.
Paul elsewhere is kind of proud of the fact that he doesn't ever ask people for money when he is ministering to and with them. He earns his money doing this tent making or leather working. And then he also founds churches and proclaims the gospel. And he does think that ministers should be paid, and he talks about that, but he himself doesn't ever ask for money. And I think there's something really nice about that. Like, it, you're offering something, you're not dependent on people. And there is this, you know, we were always warned in seminary, and I think there's something to it, that once your livelihood depends on the gospel being heard and received, the way you can talk about the gospel is different.
Yes. I feel that all the time in the Jewish community, that when I feel shifts that I wonder if such and such wouldn't be better, or such and such wouldn't serve what seems like an emerging need better, but we can't figure out a business model to make that
right.
financially viable, and that's the barrier. I'm like, oh, this is messed up. And I am part of it. I'm part of the problem because you have to pay my salary.
Absolutely. There's a freedom that comes from tent making for sure, but also quite a burden that comes.
Indeed.
Paul was, he's in a bit of an artisan class. He's a tradesperson, Priscilla and Aquila as well, but they're not like fancy people. You know what I mean? Like they're getting by. These are, working class folks who are making a living, but that's basically what they're doing.
Okay. Is there anything else we would like to raise up from these couple chapters? We've talked already about the every Sabbath arguing in the synagogue. So do we want to talk about that again? That came up in the last text
mm-hmm. as well. No, I think it's just like we were talking about there. He's from the scriptures trying to convince them that in fact, mm-hmm. his understanding of Jesus as the Messiah is correct,
mm-hmm.
which is variously received by different folks.
Yes, it is variously received, and it is not inappropriate behavior.
Right, exactly.
This would be a normal thing to be doing.
Right,
yes.
Hi, everyone. It's Bobby here. We're excited to announce our 2024 summer series on biblical images of creation. This 6-part series begins in May after Pentecost and includes texts from Genesis, Job, Psalms, Leviticus, and Ezekiel. We're especially excited to be collaborating with Spirit and Truth Publishing, which has released a Vacation Bible School and all-age Sunday school curriculum designed by experienced Christian educators called Learning Together, Created to Care, which can be used in parallel with the Bible Worm podcast on creation. For more information, visit spiritandtruthpublishing.com, patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast, or look for our posts in the Narrative Lectionary Facebook group. We're looking forward to talking about creation with you this summer. In the meantime, let's get back to this week's podcast.
Okay, so let's start to shift then to our second text, which is in the book of 1 Corinthians. We'll start in chapter 1. But maybe as we do that, or before we do that, will you tell me a little bit about Corinth?
No, it's such an important question. It's such an interesting place. And maybe every place that Paul writes to is interesting and worth talking about in that kind of a way. But Corinth had its own thing going on. It's located, Greece is like, there's the northern part, and then there's the Peloponnese in the south. And they're connected just by this little 4-mile-wide isthmus that between two bays. And so the two land masses of Greece connect on this little strip of land. And Corinth is located right there at that little strip of land, just south of it. So to the north is like Athens and Thebes, and to the south is the Peloponnese, or the southern part of Greece. To the west is the Bay of Corinth, and to the east is another bay. And so everybody trading north-south by land
mm-hmm.
and everybody trading east-west by water had to come basically through Corinth.
Mm.
And so there's like people from all over the world. There are goods coming and going. There's sailors are there. There's artisans and craftspeople. Like it was a happening place at the center of all trade in Greece. On top of that, it's a very old city. But it was destroyed by the Romans in like sometime around 150 BCE and then refounded by Julius Caesar like 100 years later in 44. So in the time that Paul's there, it's only been refounded for like 100 years.
Yeah.
So it's a very old city, but it's like...
So it's an old city, but it's...
Newly reformed.
Yeah, reformed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like I've read some commentaries that are talking about it as like everybody is nouveau riche, like there's not the old money. It's like everybody's like up and coming, but not everybody's rich, of course, but the people who are rich are like new rich.
Yeah.
So Corinth had this reputation. I described it, I think, in the podcast a couple of weeks ago as like the Las Vegas of the Roman world or something like that. It had this sense cosmopolitan and free thinking and like, there's people from all over the world. There's lots of sailors. It had a reputation of like lots of partying and women of ill repute and like all of these sorts of like what happens in Corinth stays in Corinth kind of thing.
Wow.
So it's a really, like, it's a fascinating place.
That is a fascinating place. And it's sort of like, at first I was picturing this, like, you know, the exchange of ideas and cultures that would happen in that place. But really, there are two sides to it. There, yeah. Yes, I'm sure that.
Yes.
And also a lot of transience.
Yeah.
And sometimes transience leads to all kinds of behaviors that you wouldn't do in a place you were going to stay.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're capturing some really important things. Like, so there's wealth disparity, there's sort of intellectual diversity, but there's also, like, you know, this other sort of transient sailor class, not particularly wealthy, but quite worldly. They travel around every place. And so there's lots of room for people to have lots of different ideas and lots of different cultures and values, but also room for disagreements and stratifications and things like that, which seems to be a problem in Paul's letters to the Corinthians, as they are sort of separating themselves out along some of these lines.
Oh, that's a really interesting setting to try to bring the gospel into. I mean, it seems like that would really present a lot of challenges.
Yeah.
Even just the economic disparity, let alone
any of
the other stuff.
Absolutely. Paul seems to have had an ongoing relationship with the church in Corinth. We have 1st and 2nd Corinthians in the New Testament. In 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about an earlier letter. And so there was at least 3 letters to the Corinthians. In 2 Corinthians, he talks about another letter. So there may have been 4 letters to the Corinthians, of which we only have 2, and there's a whole argument about maybe some of them got combined in here. But when Paul is writing 1 Corinthians, it's actually the second time he's corresponded with them. There's this ongoing relationship. He founded the church. He keeps in contact with it. They give him a lot of trouble, but also he has a special place for them in his heart of hearts, I think.
Is the idea that they write back to him and we just don't have those letters?
So it seems like there's a couple things that happen. Sometimes people write to Paul from the churches. Mm. Sometimes people send messengers to Paul saying, hey, we're having some issues. Here in this letter, we're going to get a reference to Chloe's people told me. And so maybe that's just like the word is getting around and people are like telling Paul, like, hey, did you hear what's happening in Corinth?
Yeah.
So there does seem to be this two-way correspondence. Sometimes it's official. Sometimes it's sort of around the way, you know?
So we are reading from chapter 1, verses 10 through 18. And I'm going to divide it into 2 sections that are very uneven, but I think they are a subject matter divide.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Now I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you be in agreement and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be united in the same mind and the same purpose. For it has been reported to me by Chloe's people that there are quarrels among you, my brothers and sisters. What I mean is that each of you says, I belong to Paul, or I belong to Apollos, or I belong to Cephas, or I belong to Christ. Has Christ been divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that no one can say that you were baptized in my name. I did baptize also the house of Stephanas. Beyond that, I do not know whether I baptized anyone else.
Paul, I love that guy. So snarky.
Yeah, that... Do you want to talk about that aside first, or should we start at the beginning?
Well, let's start at the beginning. I just think Paul is he's a funny guy. Probably Paul, he seems to have orally delivered his letters to a scribe who would write them down.
I see.
And so sometimes I think maybe Paul was talking a little bit off the cuff. But actually right here, I think he is being a little edgy in a kind of an entertaining way. But I get ahead of the story.
Okay. All right. We'll back up to the beginning first. Okay. So, you know, before I had your introduction to Corinth as this place with just so much diversity on so many levels and, you know, possibly as various ways people could disagree with each other, I wondered if I should bring into this story the fact that in the last story we heard that there had been significant upheaval connected to the Jews, perhaps in relationship to the Jews and Christ. So my question was going to be, should we be carrying that information into this reading? But now I'm not, I mean, I guess it is still a question, but now I feel less sure that there is a connection.
Yeah, no, you're seeing something really important. In some of Paul's communities, he is very much dealing with the internal relationships of Jews or Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. But that's not at the front in Corinthians in the way that it is in some other places. Mm-hmm. This seems to be more, there's this Christian community in this wildly cosmopolitan, secular place. And what does it mean to be Christian in that context?
Yeah. Okay, that's helpful. And I have to say, the first two verses here, I haven't read them that many times, but every time I read them, it kind of makes me laugh because just the idea that there should be no divisions among you seems so, it just seems so unlikely.
Yeah. Yeah, Paul has a dream, and the dream is about one people unified in worshiping Christ. And that is not the way that that has gone. And knowing that humans tend to human, that is not the way that it probably is ever going to go. That's what he's hoping for.
Yes. And I guess my question, and maybe it's more of a question for you sort of next to this text, but not necessarily of the text. Like, is that the right thing? To what extent is that what we should be looking for? I mean, I guess it seems to me from what we have read together that, yes, they have Jesus in common, and that is incredibly important. And Jesus wasn't always precise about exactly what this should look like. So it seems like it would make sense that people who care very deeply about this cause and living out this gospel would be invested in getting it right and also argue about what that should look like.
Yeah.
But do you think Paul's not even talking about that? Is he talking about something else entirely? Or is he talking about that kind of disagreement?
That's such a good question, Amy. I just had a student in my office earlier today who was talking about how they feel like she's in my Judaism, Christianity, and Islam course. And she feels like Christians always want you to think exactly the right way. And she's like, when we were studying Judaism, I really liked that they had more value about like arguing about the significance of the text and like really wrestling with each other about what we should do and think. And she's like, Christianity doesn't quite get that. And like, that's exactly kind of what you're pointing to here is the sense in which if we were all on the same team, we would all agree with each other. I don't know if Paul is saying that. Well, I mean, it seems like what he's saying, but I sort of like to tweak Paul in my own head anyway as saying, we agree on the important things. And the important thing, as Paul's going to land on, is Jesus Christ crucified. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we all have in common. And the rest is like details. Mm-hmm. But people are getting caught up in the details and forgetting about the main thing. I don't know that Paul has said that exactly right here, though.
So maybe it's almost more of a case of like, you know, losing the forest for the trees or something like that. And so that almost could suggest the opposite of what I was saying, that like, of course, there's going to be some diversity in the specific ways that people practice, but don't get obsessed with that. Like, keep your eye on the prize here.
Yes.
And the prize is on a different horizon.
Yes.
That.
That's the way that I'm reading that, but I will also say that that's the way I live my life. And so it is possible that I have bobbied the text instead of texting the Bobby. You know what I mean?
I mean, that's what instead of texting the Bobby. That's amazing. I mean, I think that's what we all do. We all read the text from where we are situated, but that's a helpful way to think about it. I wonder how it fits in with this, you know, when he goes on to explain what I mean is that each of you says, and then he's got this series of like, I belong to this guy or I belong to this guy, which I was trying to understand, you know, coming from the background of Judaism, which maybe maybe that's not a particularly helpful context here. I don't know, as being sort of like who you studied with.
Yes.
Like, who's your,
that's it.
You know, like I, this is my rabbi. This is,
yeah,
this is my master teacher. And that's what you think.
I think that's exactly it. Yeah. Who did you learn the faith from? Here it's being framed in terms of who baptized you. Mm-hmm. But I think like who initiated you into Christian belief, which I think is quite similar to what you're saying. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he's saying it doesn't matter.
Yes. So it does, you all have come into the same faith, no matter how you, who got you there and who you learned it from first and who baptized you.
Yeah.
So arguing like I'm better than you because I studied with, or I was baptized by, like, don't stop it. What matters is that we're the faith that we got into, not the conduit that got us there.
Yeah, I could see how that would be especially important where there was a, as you were just suggesting, a sort of like power differential depending,
yes,
who you had come into the faith through or with.
Right.
And not just as a, you know, like, hey, this was my, I'm class of 1995, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I still see this a lot. I mean, it's a little bit of a step, but I don't think too much of one with modern day Christianity, in which there are so many different ways of being Christian, many of which think we are the one true way of being Christian. So we have all of these denominations, which are bewildering even to people who are Christian. I can't even imagine what it looks like to people from outside the tradition who are saying my way of being Christian is the right way. And I think here Paul is saying, like, that's not really the point. Like, the mm-hmm. point is what you share in common, not the details. Like, it's fine for you to be Presbyterian and you to be Lutheran and you to be a Baptist or whatever, but like, that's not your identity.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Your identity is Christ. I love that he puts Christ last there. So I belong to Paul. I belong to Apollos. I belong to Cephas. I belong to Christ, right? So it's like,
yeah,
the fourth one in the list is the one that actually matters. Like, almost like it's an afterthought. Like, oh yeah, oh yeah.
Oh yeah, that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I love that he uses his own self as the example.
Yeah.
Was Paul crucified for you?
Yeah.
Were you baptized in the name of Paul? Okay, and then there's this funny part.
Thank God I didn't baptize any of you, is what he says in the CEB translation.
I know, but then all these exceptions.
Yeah.
Bobby, what is happening?
I'm so curious what you think that's about, just reading it.
I mean, I guess it feels to me like, it feels a little ego-y to me.
Yeah, I think you can totally read it that way.
Or possibly, it seems like maybe he's just slipped into a stream of consciousness,
yeah,
kind of thing. But it seems a little bit, it seems like it could hurt someone's feelings if you baptize them and you really don't even remember it. Like, this,
yeah,
was this super important moment to them. You're like, I don't know if I've ever baptized anybody. Like, I don't know. I don't know how to read it. And I don't know why it's here, unless it just, this is just how the letter came out and he didn't have an editor.
Like, if this was a podcast, he would have gone back and Audacity
and, said, that's distracting,
and clipped that
like
up.
Like, you just made a really...
Not that I ever do that for our
never,
podcast.
Never, because we never go into stream of consciousness.
We never, ever do.
Yeah, I guess it feels distracting to me from like a really strong rhetorical point.
Yeah.
That he just made. Like, he made it too strongly and then had to walk it back and then...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. So the first thing I always think is like, the poor guy who Paul had baptized and didn't get mentioned here. So I'm glad I didn't baptize anybody. Oh yeah, I said so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And it'd be like, what about me? Like,
it's like
my little four heart of hearts. You know,
never
that's like,
thank
oh,
anybody. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Like, publicly thank and like, oh, yeah, give the list of thank yous at the end of an event, because you will always,
yeah,
always forget somebody.
Another way that it is read is that Paul actually is being dismissive here. And he is saying that baptism is actually not that important.
Yeah.
He's especially saying who baptized you is not that important. He may be saying that baptism itself is not that important. And so, like, yeah, you might be offended. Or even Stephanus, the house of Stephanus, who's like the P.S., you know, like, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. They might be offended. And I think Paul is a little bit saying, like, fine. Like, this should be offensive. Like, it does not matter. It is so unimportant to me that I baptized you that I totally forgot about it.
Yeah.
And he, by blundering his way through this, he actually makes that point really sharp.
Yeah.
And so you kind of wonder if it's a rhetorical strategy to be completely dismissive in a way that is a little hurtful, but does make the point.
I can really see that. I really see that possibility here, that he is precisely trying to say these things that you're paying attention to and that you're identifying so strongly with do not matter.
At all. Yep.
I've already forgotten them.
I'm not even thinking about it. I forgot you the moment I baptized you.
Right. And you know, we've talked a while ago about the role of personal relationships and familiar relationships within the group of people in the budding church and the followers of Christ, and how it's been something that I've struggled with as a Jew reading the text, because sometimes I've felt like the message was you have to leave these people. Yeah. You're not allowed to care about other people. But the more helpful place that I think I've landed in conversation with you is that it's very tempting to orient yourself entirely there in that like personal connection and that sense of relationship to another person. And that's where we want to be grounded.
Yes.
And maybe that was part of what was so powerful about Jesus's ministry coming through a person in a body that the disciples could be with.
Yes.
And so now in this next generation, they don't have Jesus in a body walking around with them. So it makes sense they would latch on to whoever was the person. And so it is painful to say, don't latch on to that. But there is a very strong sense here that like, I will not make that relationship an option for you because I'm going to cut it off.
Right. You said that really nicely. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Smarts, though.
Smarts.
I don't use that word enough.
No.
That's smarts.
I'm going to use it more.
The one other thing that I don't have much to say about, but I feel I would be remiss if I did not mention it, is that this is all reported to Paul by a group identified as Chloe's people.
Yes.
The people associated with a woman. I don't know who Chloe is, but it's nice to see that she's got people.
She does have people.
Identified through her.
Yeah.
And not through
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she seems to be the head of her household. Maybe she's the head of some house church, and so it's those sorts of people. Or maybe she's the head of a household, and these are the people who belong to her, either as family or as people who work for her. We don't know about Chloe from anywhere else. Mm-hmm. It's not entirely clear whether Chloe is in Corinth, or Paul is writing this letter, we find out in chapter 16, from Ephesus, where he has traveled after. So maybe Chloe is in Ephesus, but her people are back and forth with Corinth, and so she's reporting it. We don't know a lot about her, but what you're saying is exactly right. She is an important enough person to be the head of the household, and Paul seems to take her word or the word of her people pretty seriously.
Yeah. All right. Shall we go on to the last couple verses?
Let's do.
Okay. I'm picking up in verse 17. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to proclaim the gospel, and not with eloquent wisdom, so that the cross of Christ might not be emptied of its power. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Bobby.
He just cut to it right there after that whole like, baptism. Like you think he's sort of lost his train of thought, and then he's like, bam.
Yeah. No, he's not. It's like the absent-minded professor, but they're not absent-minded at all.
Reminds me of our professor of blessed memory, John Hayes, who, you know, was a country sharecropper from Alabama, and he had this sort of aw shucks thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you would sort of start to think he was just like a country boy who didn't know what he was talking about. But I mean, the man was a genius who knew everything. Mm-hmm. And then he would just like, all of a sudden he would just come at you and you'd be like, oh, I have been cut to the quick. That's smarted.
That's right.
Paul is doing a little bit of that aw shucks thing and then like hitting it home.
Yeah. Bobby, what does it mean for the cross to have a power that can be emptied with eloquent wisdom?
I mean, I think what Paul is saying here is that at its core, the gospel of Jesus Christ is really simple. It is simply the cross. Jesus crucified. And when Paul talks about the crucifixion, he also has in mind the resurrection. That's it. We can talk about that in all kinds of complex and convoluted ways. We can enact that in all sorts of ritual ways that we can argue about the meaning of the ritual, or we can argue about the fine points of theology. We can write confessions of the church that disagree on the fine points. You can, in all of that, you can lose the point, which for Paul is the only point, which is Jesus crucified and resurrected. And so I really think Paul is onto something there. Like in all of, ironically, I'm using lots of words to explain this too, as is my wont. But that in the rush of words and ideas, you can lose this. It's not a simple gospel, but it is a clear gospel that doesn't need a lot of eloquence to explain it.
Mm.
What do you think about that?
I think a lot of different things about it. I think there are definitely ways in which I relate to that. I relate to it sort of. I both relate to it and don't. Okay, I'll say some more things about that.
It seems appropriate.
Here's what I relate to. I have definitely had experiences with Jewish liturgy or teachings or various beautiful ways that people have tried to speak about God, whether these are like the psalmists or, you know, later Jews, where my experience has been, if nothing like this kind of thing has ever happened, like this is not awakening some kind of thing that I already knew but maybe didn't have words for, usually for me, it is the case that reading the words of the psalmist or reading the words in the liturgy is not going to make me understand it if I didn't understand it on some level before. No matter how beautiful the words are, like I'm not going to find faith in a prayer book.
Yeah.
And so I feel like in some ways, maybe that is related to what Paul is saying, that like I'm not going to be able to intellectually, I can't get to you intellectually through this. I'm not going to be able to persuade you through beautiful rhetoric that this is compelling and meaningful. And I can't really explain to you what it means beyond the fact that it is, you know? Right. So for me, it would be the fact that God is. That's really all there is. Like that's,
yes.
That's the extent of it. And we've spilled a lot of ink about it. So I relate to that, but let me stop first there and say, like, do you relate what I just said at all to what Paul is saying, or am I kind of going off in a different direction?
No, I think that makes sense. I mean, part of what's happening is, what does Paul mean by the cross and foolishness and all of those things, which we'll need to talk about, which is not exactly the same thing as God is, and you know it, but you can't be convinced of it. You can't be convinced of it by words. I mean, I think that mutatis mutandis, you know, changing the necessary things, those things are related. Yeah. And in fact, I think Paul is saying that sometimes the words can point to the preacher. So not only is it not going to convince you of what is true, but it's actually going to distract you from the possibility of understanding what is true. Because what you get drawn to is like, wow, listen to how fancy that preacher talks.
That was my initial sort of reading of this, was that there was a way in which like the beautiful rhetoric or eloquent wisdom or whatever would somehow become like the container that's supposed to hold the thing. But the container becomes so beautiful that then you're just looking at the container and you've lost track of what it was supposed to be holding.
So the thing needs to be contained in some way. Like the container is a good thing.
Yes.
But the container does not want to be so fancy that you forget about the gospel that's being held inside of it. I think that's right.
Yeah. How do you hold that as a preacher, Bobby? Like, you're a good preacher. Do you think about this question? Like, I feel like this would, like, haunt me.
Yeah, it is pretty haunting, for sure. And, like, I mean, I have heard preachers who have transformed me.
Yes.
And they were eloquent preachers.
Yes.
And I would not say that what they did was this. Like, they had fancy words that pointed me to Christ. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that it's necessarily that, like, being a good preacher is a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just making sure that you're oriented toward the right thing, which is proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ and him crucified, according to Paul. And I also know preachers, nobody who's listening right now, though, I assure you, who their preaching is about, look how good I can preach, right?
Yeah.
And you can tell the difference. There's a lack of authenticity there for some people. That they wrote a nice sermon, but, like, it didn't go anywhere. It was just nice words. So I've experienced both of those things. I've also experienced people who point me to Christ who they're not even preaching. They're just talking. And they say really profound things in the simplest way possible. And I'm thinking here of some of my Mercy Church and Canvas friends. They don't need to have a well-composed sermon to preach the gospel. And so I think that at the end of the day, it's where is it pointing you that matters.
I love that.
This thing about the cross and the cross is foolishness to those who are being destroyed, but life or power of God for those who are being saved. First of all, the idea that the cross is the point, this makes some people really uncomfortable. And I think maybe it should. Like, the cross is a really violent thing. And it has come to be associated with this sort of sacrificial atonement model that God needed a sacrifice in order to be okay with human beings. And it sort of puts violence at the center of God. I myself don't think that that's what Paul is trying to do here. I think Paul is living in this apocalyptic world in which he sees the alternatives that we've been talking about through the Gospel of Mark, the empire of Rome, the empire of God, which one are you going to be loyal to? And the cross is the moment. Like, the Romans used the cross, ironically. And what they were doing was they were lifting up people who were got a little uppity, to use, you know, modern speak. Mm-hmm. And saying, like, fine, if you want to think you're better than us, we'll show you who's better. And so they put people up on a cross for stepping out of their place. And they use violence to hold people down in that way and use that as a way of demonstrating their power. We can wield the power of death over you. But the irony is, when they lift up Jesus that way, they actually, like, Jesus actually is being enthroned over them on the cross, because the power of death has no hold over him, and life, in fact, wins that battle. And so Jesus's cross is an evidence of the power of life over the power of death, and therefore the power of God over the power of Rome. And so it undermines the whole imperial logic.
Yes.
And so the cross has to be there so you can see the irony, so you can understand how the violence of the empire has been exposed and undermined by the resurrection of Jesus. That sounds like lifting up the cross as the central thing is foolishness. It was like the people who got crucified, I mean, it was a horrible way to die. And it was like a joke. Like, you were, and then we saw that in the mocking of Jesus at his crucifixion. Like, their point was to make fun of you. And so just to say, like, yes, that's who we're holding up, it seems foolishness to the imperial logic. And so people hear this line of those who are being destroyed, that is people who still think according to imperial logic. They don't get it. It seems foolish to them. But those who understand what is happening, it's that they see the power of God in that crucifixion. Sorry, I feel that was my little sermon.
No, that was helpful and interesting. And I was thinking, I was thinking as you were talking, I had originally read that as read verse 18 as sort of, I guess, connected to what I was saying about my experience before, that there's no logical argument that I will be able to make to you that is going to make you say like, of course Jesus was resurrected. Like if you don't, like, you know, it's not an intellectual, argument to have.
Yes.
I guess I had seen this, you're not going to like this reading, Bobby, but as the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, meaning those who don't already believe in it.
Mm.
Like those who don't have belief, it's foolishness. And to those who have belief, it is the power of God. But I guess I'm not sure how to get from a state of unbelief to a state of belief using language.
Yeah.
And thus ends the podcast, because we can only use language now. but that might not, but Paul's certainly not telling people not to talk about this. I mean, Paul is on the, you know, evangelism bandwagon. So
Paul most certainly does not think if you don't get it right now, you can never get it, right? Because his whole thing is I'm going to go out in the world and I'm going to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm not here to baptize. I'm here to preach the good news. And so I know this isn't exactly what you mean, but it's not as simple as unless you already get it, you're not going to get it. Yeah. It is entirely possible that you could yet still get it. But I love where you landed, although I'm not sure that either one of us was thinking about this, but it's beyond the power of language. That's exactly right. Paul is like, it doesn't, talking about the cross is hard. It is the cross. Like it's that symbol and what it means, which is this is the instrument of execution of the imperial power coupled with the resurrection. Yeah. I cannot explain that to you.
Yes.
But I can point you to it. Yeah. And you can think about that and say, ah, this empire that can wield death over me ultimately has no power because God is more powerful than that. I don't know how to talk about that. I don't know how to write a dissertation about that. I don't know how to explain that. But if you can get that, you got it.
Yeah. What the way you just said that, Bobby, was making me think of something you said a few weeks ago that, you know, if you could put a symbol or a ritual, if you could communicate more easily in words, you would just say it in words.
Yes.
But there are things that a symbol can communicate or a ritual can communicate because it allows for complex multivocality. Yes, that's the word. And all these sort of conflicting meanings to be held together in that thing.
Yes.
So then I love the fact that he says it's the cross. Like it's not the story of the cross. It's the cross.
I think that's exactly right. And in 18, you know, Paul says the message of the cross is foolishness. And so one of the challenges now is you can't actually experience the cross as a cross. Now what you've got is people telling you about the cross. And now we've got the problem of language again, right?
Right.
And so we've got to talk about it in order to see it. But if we talk about, once we start talking about things, we obfuscate them. And this is the conundrum of proclaiming the gospel, I think.
Yeah.
But to proclaim the gospel in ways that show people the cross, that's the point.
It's such an interesting connection to what he was just saying that, you know, people get so attached to whoever it was who baptized them and
yes.
we get so attached to the language that we use to hold, you know, hold the story of the cross. But both of those things are not really what we're supposed to be paying attention to.
That's exactly
right. They're necessary.
Right.
They're necessary.
Yeah. They are necessary, but some of what he's been talking about before, and I think what connects this passage together, is these things about, I'm better than you because Cephas baptized me. I'm better than you because Apollos baptized me. I think one of the things he's saying here is those kinds of divisions are the kinds of divisions that empire makes, where we're thinking hierarchies, stratifications, divisions, who's my people, who's my patron.
Yeah.
And once you start down that road, it is clear that you have not understood the cross which is about a whole other way of being in the world. Yes. And so these divisions are not just divisions. They are also evidence that the empire still got its grip on you. And so you got to find a way to get past that and find the common thing, which is the power of life given by God over the power of death witnessed in the cross.
Bobby, we are just about at the time when we usually start moving into final reflections. What are you thinking about all this at this moment?
I mean, I struggle with Paul. I'll just put that out there. But I think Paul, in this one little simple saying here in 17 and 18, really has hit the chord. I mean, appropriately so. Like, this is what you need. And it opens up in all of these complicated ways that we can think about and argue about and talk about and figure out how they work out. But this one thing, Christ crucified by the empire, wielding the power of death as the ultimate power, lifting him up to demonstrate how they can hold him down, and then God redeeming all of that through the resurrection, the power of life over death, that's what matters. That's what the gospel is. And it's so easy to lose track of that, I think, and to get into theological arguments and what's really happening in the Eucharist and at what age should you baptize people? Like, all of these things that we can find, we find all this time to argue about. But in fact, what Paul is saying here is, at the end of the day, all in the world the gospel is about is the power of life given by God over the power of death wielded by the empire. And so we put ourselves on the side of the things that give life to the world and the things that bring life to people and the things that destabilize the structures of the empire and the things that recognize the wholeness of humankind. All of these things follow from that life wins the ultimate battle over death at the cross. All of the rest is details. So put yourself on the side of life. I really think at the end of the day is what Paul is saying. And there's a lot of nuance in that, and we can talk about that. But the question of, am I serving the power of life witnessed in the resurrection, or am I serving the power of death witnessed in the powers of the empire, is a great place to start in thinking about what it means to live a life of the gospel and to proclaim a gospel to the world. That's what I'm thinking about that.
That's really beautiful, Bobby. And I, on some level, I just want to say, yes, you should think about that. And I can see the whole thing is in the whole thing that you just said, sort of in terms that terms that don't refer to Jesus. What does that even mean? But the same thing happens, of course, in the Jewish community where we lose the forest for the trees. Like, we forget what it is that we're really gathered for, and then find all the ways that we can argue about relatively inconsequential things that just feel really important in the moment. I want to put one other idea on the table just that felt so important to me as I was reading this text, and it didn't come up that much in our conversation, but I at least want to put it out there. And it has to do more with the role of community in our lives and community formation and how we make decisions to show up for each other and intertwine our lives, the lives that we have here on earth for the time being. And so if folks are interested in that question, I want to point you to a book that came out called The Amen Effect, I guess, by Rabbi Sharon Brouse. And the reason I thought about it while I was reading these texts is that she talks about these different relationships and community, one of which she describes as sort of instrumental or practical, like the kinds of relationships you have with other parents at your kid's school that you have for the time that your kids are in the school, and then maybe you never see them again after your kids graduate. And that reminded me of the tent maker. Like, we're going to live together because we're going to go to work together.
Oh, yeah.
But she talks about how that kind usually, it can connect you closely for a short time, but it doesn't have staying power. Whereas when you have a shared purpose that you hold together, that really can hold you together for a very long time. And that is that. Entirely what Paul is talking about in 1 Corinthians. So it just was, I don't know, lovely to see it move from one to the other just across these texts. And the last one that she mentions that I hope is in here too, although it wasn't explicitly in our text today, but a sense of personal care for one another. That she was saying, like, she's been a part of many powerful social justice communities that have a sense of shared vision, but not a sense of care for one another. And that's not, they do great work, but it's not quite a community.
Yeah.
And so figuring out how to balance those couple things in community life hopefully can be supportive of everybody's relationship to their, to the ultimate, but also keep them grounded on earth.
Yeah. I really love that, Amy. And I really appreciate your connecting back to the Acts passage and the 1 Corinthians 1 passage and that idea of community made in sort of the grounded ways. That's a really lovely way of putting that together. Next week, when we get to 1 Corinthians 13, we're going to talk about the ethic of love, which is meant to underlie all of the community's actions together. I don't know if that'll quite speak to your point or not, but it's a really lovely
maybe
text.
Maybe it will. No, that's great. That's great. I love it. Yeah, man. Community formation is no joke.
That's true.
Important work. Yeah.
Important work.
Well, thank you, my friend, for a great conversation, and I will see you again next time.
All right, Amy. Thanks. Okay.
Bye. Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Bible Worm. If you've enjoyed this free podcast, we hope you'll help us keep it going by joining our Patreon for as little as $4 per month. You can also sign up for other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more. Visit patreon.com/Bibleworm podcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced and edited by Bobby Williamson. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby, and our theme music is The World at Large by Dano Songs. Many thanks to all of our Patreon supporters for helping make this podcast possible.
Next week, we'll read more of his letter to the city with one of its best loved passages, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 through 13. Until then, keep on digging.